Okay, so I want to derive today the construction of this 2 plus 1 spin four model. Before, because of one of the questions I got last time, I want to recall something about the particle I did not mention. So I say that when I couple gravity, you know, in 2 plus 1, so does it work, this guy? You get a flat space-time with a deficit angle here, which is 8 pi gm. So clearly, you know, a deficit angle cannot be bigger than 2 pi. This means that I get a bound, a maximal mass that I can localize in my space-time. And that's one of the special features of 2 plus 1. But you might wonder whether this is just special to 2 plus 1 or whether this is more generic, and why is it happening? It's happening for the following reason, is that if you look at the Planck lens in 2 plus 1, the Planck lens in 2 plus 1 is proportional to, let's say, 4 pi gh bar. But now the Planck mass in 2 plus 1 is h bar over Lp. And, you know, it's 1 over 4 pi g. And the Planck mass, this is in 2 plus 1.
Oh, okay, sorry.
In 3 plus 1, exactly, there's a square. Lp square is 4 pi gh. And then Mp is h bar over Lp is just going to be now square root of h over square root of 4 pi g. So what is the difference between 2 plus 1 and 3 plus 1? Is that, well, you know, Lp is proportional to h bar. So when I go to the classical limit, I get, you know, my minimum length scale goes to 0, as it should. But if I look at the Planck mass, you know, is also contain h bar. So it's a quantum quantity in 3 plus 1. Whereas in 2 plus 1, you see that there's no h bar in the Planck mass. So it's a purely classical quantity. So in some sense, 2 plus 1 is special because you are seeing the effect of having a Planck mass scale in your theory, right, at the classical level. And you expect that the effect you see there might be, you give you an idea of what is the effect of having a maximum Planck mass scale at the quantum level. Okay, so this is why you have, and you can see this type of, it's a quantum gravity effect if you want, but which is purely classical because of some dimensional reason there. Okay, so let me go. So I derived last time the configuration space, and for 2 plus 1 gravity, we have seen that we have a pair of Wehrbein field and connection B. Let's say I'm looking at a manifold, which is a cylinder, sigma cross I, an interval, time is going like that. And this is epsilon AB delta IJ. So it tells me that the wave functionals are going to be functionals of omega. And I'm going to look at wave functionals that are spin network wave functionals, which are labeled by a graph. And I'm going to restrict, because I'm in 2 plus 1, and that's enough, to trivalent graph. And then edges are colored by a representation of SU2, G1, G2, G3. And the intertwiner, I don't need to specify it, because I restrict to a three-dimensional graph, and there's a unique intertwiner there. What? It's enough to describe any geometry that has an area. This is minimal and consistent. I can look at more complicated, but I can describe a dynamic because it's a super selection sector of my dynamics. So I don't really need to include more. Okay? And it contains, you know, if I know the value of these functions for all these graphs, I can, you know, reconstruct the connection. And the dynamics doesn't generate higher valency graph. I need at least three, otherwise there's no area there, but three is enough. So now the idea is that I want to compute the expectation value of phi gamma 1, phi gamma 0, which is the integral. Is there one that works? Because I think you don't see that. Integral over all, same thing. So there's not one guy that really give me. Can you see it or? Yeah? Okay. Let's see. Maybe this one is. Is it better? It's better? Phi gamma. And let's say, you know, okay. I'm integrating here over E and omega. I'm a action, phi gamma of omega, phi gamma 1 of omega. Okay. So the idea is that I want to compute this object for all possible graphs, right, gamma 0 and gamma 1. And then if I know this data for all possible graphs, I'm really describing a continuum theory there. So the problem is that I don't exactly know. I need to be able to define this path integral. So I'm going to introduce a discretization in order to define this path integral. And then the philosophy is then to be able to take a continuum limit of this discretization in order to get the true continuum limit of this amplitudes. The trick is that I'm going to be smart enough to find a discretization which respects as much as it can the symmetry of the theory, so that the continuum limit is trivially taken. That is, I'm going to find an action on a lattice which somehow sits at the fixed point of the randomization group. And so taking the continuum limit is very simple. So that's the idea of Ponzano-Régy model.
You have to take the context from the data.
Yes. Sorry. okay. So... So let's start by a discretization of the gravity action. So, my graph are supported on my states are supported by a graph on the boundary, and I want to compute these things by using a spinform model. But before, what I can do is so let me suppose that I select a spin, a two-dimensional complex S which interpolate between gamma zero and gamma one. Okay, then I'm going to write the action. So maybe I should call it, S like that. This is a two-dimensional spin form. So it's a two-dimensional complex. And I want to discretize my gravity action. So I want to have a discretization of E and omega. So a spin form is made of plaquettes. The building block of this two-dimensional complex are faces or plaquettes, which are obtained by a collection of edges. And I'm going to interpret the one skeleton of S as some type of lattice, right? And I'm going to use the same discretization as in lattice QCD. That is, I'm going to associate the discretization of a connection in a lattice gauge series obtained by the fact that each time I see an edge of the spin form, an oriented edge of the spin form, I assign to this oriented edge a group element GE, okay? And then I'm going to discretize also the Wehrbein field, EI, by assigning I have a wedge product here in my action. My action is integral of EI wedge F I of omega. So in some sense, I have to be able to okay, if I discretize my connection like that, it's well known that the notion of curvature, okay, is obtained by looking at the holonomy around a given edge. So the notion of a discrete curvature is given by a group element, which is now the product of all edge in a given face of my spin form. And the product is ordered to go around like that to be product of the group element E, where E is oriented along the orientation of the face, and you take the convention that G of the minus E is just G of E minus 1. So going along an edge with opposite orientation is the inverse of the group. I need to discretize the metric, EI of mu, and the metric of the V by fin is also one form, so I can somehow integrate it also along lines. The thing is that this one form should pair with respect to the curvature, which is the F omega now becomes this holonomy, a group element. So what I do is that I discretize my Wehrbein field by associating to any face F a Lie algebra element. Okay, the idea is being that I have my little face here, And then I have a dual edge that goes through. And this Lie algebra element XF is the integral of E along this line here, this dual line. And then I have a natural pairing between one form here and the surface term. Okay? So that's my basic data, my dynamical variable, just like, you know, our collections of GE and XF. My action is, which depends on GE and XF, just going to be the sum over all faces of my spin foam time the trace. So XF is the Lie algebra element, and I take the trace of a Lie algebra element in the SU2 representation times GF.
So what are the properties of this XF with respect to the H transformations, with respect to the reactance?
Well, so you have a notion, you have a, you know, you have a kind of dual lattice, and you can have an action of the gauge transformations at the vertex, and if you want, you can put together the lattice and its dual so that it's the usual gauge transformation. No. I'm discretizing, let's say. For each phase, you have to fix it. So starting point, you know, when I define this GF, you know, I've defined, you know, a starting point here, and then I multiply this group element, and I come back here. And then the action of XF here is the action. So I have an action of the gauge group at this vertex. Okay. The Lorentz gauge transformations are not a problem, and essentially this is a compact gauge group. So I will not talk about it. It's interesting to talk about it, but it's very usual. It's very similar to the usual lattice gauge theory. What I'm interested in is the other type of symmetry, translational symmetry or default symmetry, which are not usual. So that's my action, 1F. Here you might worry, okay, usually there should be a factor 1 over 8 pi g in front, but I reabsorb that in the dimension of x, so I work in variable, I can always that, because I work with zero cosmological constants, so I reabsorb x so that it's kind of, you know, the measure of distances in Planck unit. And for pure gravity, it doesn't matter. I can always do that. When I couple to matter, it will reappear. So that's my action. And let's say, so now I have to, and essentially the partition function, the object I want to compute, phi gamma 1, phi gamma 0, is now defined as being, you know, it depends on my choice of spin foam, or my choice of two complex, a priori, and it's defined to be the product over F, dxf, the product over E, dg, exponential, I, S. Phi, gamma, this is phi gamma 1, phi gamma 0, g bar 0. Where the restriction is that if I have a phase that touches the boundary, then the group element which sits here is the one associated. So if this one is part of a spin network graph, then when I integrate over all these elements, there's a condition that, that of course, the group element I assign to this edge here is exactly the same as the one that appears in the boundary wave functional. Okay? So I've restricted this spin network to be a trivalent for a reason of convenience, but it's not at all fundamental. I'm going to restrict the moves also to be somehow trivalent. So that is, I'm using a spin foam which contains only vertices of that type. I do. So I'm going to restrict to that picture. You know, that picture. In this case, if I do this restriction, it's nice to see that there is in fact a natural triangulation picture. So on the boundary of a surface sigma, and I have a graph, trivalent graph, which is there. But the trivalent graph is not really dual to a two-dimensional triangulation, right? If I have a triangle, a triangulation like that, if I have a graph like that, I can think of each vertex as being dual to a smaller triangle, each edge dual to an edge, and each face dual to a vertex of the triangulation. And similarly, here, this object is dual to a tetrahedra. Okay, so each edge, so the vertex is dual to the tetrahedra. Each edge arising in this vertex is dual to a face here. And then each face here is dual to an edge, right? The correspondence of duality is between, you know, objects which are d-dimensional and 3 minus d-dimensional. So you can also think of this picture as being a triangulation. And then this is really very much like what you would do in, you know, lattice gauge theory. Okay, so now we want to compute this this object. Let me say for a reason, I have to choose a normalization, so let me take that dx means d3x over 8 pi, for a reason that's going to become clear just now. And let's do the computation, and let's see what we get there. There's something about these blackboards. It's true that the more gentle you are, the more efficient the erasing is. It's just it's like a training. It's a Zen blackboard. So the first thing we're going to use is that we have a basic identity that integral d3x over 8 pi. What time did I start for? 15?
Quarter past.
Okay. Times exponential I trace of x g. So I view x is a vector in R3, but it's also an element in the Lie algebra, right? And these things. Is equal to the delta function on the group, the R measure delta function. Should I prove it? Well, let's see. Maybe I go slowly. The way you would prove it sounds a bit okay. If people are surprised by that or not? It's either obvious or surprising.
No, I think it's
obvious. Okay, this is true. Okay, then I can give a proof later if you need it. Okay, so this is true. This simple lemma. And that means that I can start to integrate out, this very simple, in fact, it's a very simple action and discretization now. I'm not gentle enough, you see. I'm in a hurry, and the blackboard feels that. Zen, you should not want anything from this blackboard. Okay, so this is a delta function for the group SO3. Okay, so SO3 is the double of it's half of SU2. But now we know that, as we have shown in the first lecture or second lecture, that I can expand the delta function in terms of... So if I use that, I can make the integration there, and I get something which looks very simple, which is then that my expectation value here is the integral over the product over E of dGE times the product over all phase of a delta function associated with each phase. And then I have my phi gamma 0 here. But now I can expand the delta function of a group element in terms of a sum of a character. And if I'm in SO3, it means I'm summing only over integer spins. But, you know, I can relax this condition. And let me do compute this, you know, I continue this computation by doing some formal manipulation where I exchange the summation over G with the integration over G. So then I'm left with the fact that my scalar product is the sum over all, and I have such an identity for every face here. So sum over all spin GF, a product for all face of DGF. And then an integral of a product over E, DGE, and the product over F of character GEF of GF. And you remember that this is the holonomy there, so this is, it contains several GEs. Yeah. Okay. So I'm left over if I want to finish the computation, and then there's the phi gamma 1, phi gamma. So let me first suppose that I'm looking at a manifold, let's say, without boundary, and I will compute these terms in a second. So there's no external states, and I'm just computing these partition functions for a certain manifold with a certain topology. Okay. So I want to perform these integrals there. So so I have to integrate over a group element associated to edges of my spin foam. And the problem is that an edge appears in different phase of the spin foam. Okay? So let me look at one edge. What is happening around one edge here, E? So I've restricted my spin foam configuration to be such that there's always three face that meet around a given edge. I guess you don't see the red, right?
Find another red.
A black red. Okay, doesn't work. Okay. So it means what? It means that in this product there is the element GE appear three times. So there's the face, GF labeled by GF1, GF2, and GF3 here. And essentially, it appears one because there's the product of holonomy in this face. It appears a second time because there's the product of holonomy, let's say, in this face. And it appears a third time there below because there's a product of holonomy around this face. And then for each edge, I have to make an integral over DGE. Okay? But so it means if I flatten out this configuration, I'm doing the integral over DGE of a product of three matrix elements, in representation G1, G2, G3, which are then connected to other group elements, like that. But we have seen that in the beginning, how to do this type of computation using this fusion identity that I was talking about, which you can obtain by summing over P and Q, dP, dQ, and then fusing one time, and then fusing another time, where you have G1, G2, G3, P, P, Q, and then G1, G2, G3. And then the intertwining property means that you can go there, and this integral is just tells you that the integral of a group element is such that Q should be just the trivial representation. And I get that at the end of the day, this computation is just going to be the product of two Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Okay? So we already did that computation that I'm redoing here. So okay, so that's what happened when I integrate one group element at an edge, and I'm using the fact that this group element is appearing in three characters, so there are three matrix elements, and each time I integrate, I get this group element. So in order to see what's going on, let me look at what's happening around a vertex. So around a vertex, I had this drawing, so I have these four valent vertex here, and all the faces are meeting. Let me flatten out this vertex. So it's a four valent vertex, like that. And Well, okay. So there is six face meeting, one, two, you know, three, four, and then there's the upper five, six, like that. Okay? So when I'm doing this integration, I'm doing integration over all product of group element, and let me put now all the faces as little lines here, and then the picture I get is that around the vertex, I have this type of configuration that arises, where here is group element associated to the edge 1, you know, edge 2, edge 3, edge 4, and this is, let's say, G1, G2, etc. And then I have to integrate over DG1, DG2, etc. Okay? And then each integral here does exactly what I just described. So each integral just inserts a product of Clebsch-Gordan coefficient here. Okay. And then I obtain something, and yeah, and I should. So these six faces carry, you know, a representation label, which is, let's say, G1, G2, G3, and then G4, G5, G4, G5, G6. And I obtain this object here. So if I flatten out a bit, this is just a, you know, a picture of a tetrahedra. Okay. One. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay? So that means what? That means that here I'm taking four Clebsch-Gordan coefficients and I'm contracting them, you know, according to the line. Or if I remember this definition of spin network functional, I'm taking the spin network functional associated to this graph colored by these six representations and evaluated it at the identity element. And this is by definition, call a 6J symbol, J1, J2, J3, J4, J5, J6. So the notations that 1, 2, 3 are the same vertex, they're upstairs, and then 1 is opposite to 4, 2, 5, and 3, 6. So if I use this 6J symbol, and I'm going to talk a bit more about some of its properties, then... No, I gave this one. The evaluation of the identity of the spin network functional.
Oh,
yeah. And if I continue the computation, not including the boundary states, then I obtain that my so now I have just a partition function associated to my two-dimensional complex is expressed as a sum over spins here, product over all face, DGF, product over all vertices of 6J symbols that contains the, you know, six faces meeting around this vertex, GF1, GF6. Okay, and the geometrical picture is that if you think in terms of the dual, faces are dual to edges of triangulation, right? And this vertex is dual to a tetrahedra. So what I'm and the sum over spins here is interpreted as a sum over the geometry, and this geometry here is something like the edge length of the, and we're going to see how, why I can give this interpretation in another manner. These spins are the edge lengths of the edge of the triangulation. And I'm summing over all possible discrete geometry. But now I've seen that because of the group structure in the beginning or because of this quantum effect, now these edge lengths are quantized in this model. If I want now to include boundary states, this is very easy because... what happens is that on the boundary, Now there's a, instead of having if I look at an edge which is on the boundary, instead of having three faces that meet, there's only one boundary face that arrive here, and then there's the contribution from the spin network. So I have a group element attached to a boundary face, and I have a group element attached to the spin network here. And if I do the integration there, this is going to give me just you know, this contribution. So the integral of two group elements is just you know, bunch of product of two delta functions, as we have seen. So essentially, what it's telling me is that the spin label representation that I put here should be identified to the spin representation of the boundary. And so it's telling me that now the partition function here, phi gamma 1, phi gamma 0, of S delta, so of S, two-dimensional complex that goes from gamma 1, gamma 0, with fixed spins on the boundary. It's just the same expression, except that now the sum is only over internal faces. And then there's a condition that the spin of the boundary of the face is equal to the spin that I've put on the boundary. Okay? And that's the definition of the amplitude I get. Okay? So now we want to study a bit this amplitude. And I hope the derivation is clear. It's a basic derivation, but and we have used, that's why I had to introduce some of the group theory. We have used, you know, a bit all the group theory we have introduced. Okay, so there are many things to see about this. The first thing to get familiar is what is a Sigges symbol. So I gave this definition there. Another definition which is very convenient, if you go to the non-compact group case, Lorentzian case, the definition I gave doesn't really extend. But in there's one definition that extends the non-compact group case. It's 4, 5, 6. So if I look at these collections of intertwiner glued together, this is a trivalent intertwiner, so I know that it's proportional to the unique intertwiner that can intertwine three representations. And then the coefficient of proportionality is the Sigges symbol. Okay, this is the same kind of definition that I used before, because if I cap it by another trivalent intertwiner, since this guy is normalized, this is the same. But when there is non-compact group, this definition makes sense. So now there's this Sigges symbol has three main properties. So one, there's an orthogonality property. There's something called the Biden-Arelliot identity that these objects satisfy. And there is what is the value of its asymptotic? The first property of unitarity, okay. I'm using another definition or property of the Sigges symbol is that if now I look at this object, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this is a four-valent vertex here. But I know that I've said that if I contract two three-valent vertex, this gives me a basis of the space of four-valent intertwiners. So, you know, I can expand this object in terms of a sum over dg6. And the coefficient which is in front here is the Sigges symbol. Okay, so that's another definition of the Sigges symbol. The interest of this definition is that we see that if I fix 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 4, 5, what I'm doing is that I'm mapping one basis onto another basis, right? And I know, and if I do that twice, I go back to the same basis. I'm taking a vertical object and I'm expanding the other horizontal one. So I know that matrix element between you know, orthonormal basis are just unitary matrices. So this object is a unitary matrix, so it satisfies an identity of the form, you know, sum over GSX, DG6 of G1, G2, G3, g4, g5, g6, and then the same object, 1, 2, g1, g2, g4, g5, g3 prime, g6, is equal to delta g3 prime over dg3. Okay? The other property that this object is satisfying can be viewed, if you think about this identity as being, here is one triangle, here is another triangle, and I'm doing a flip move. I'm just changing, you know, I have a square, and I just change the orientation of the internal edge there. And then essentially, the CG symbol just assign a unitary matrix to each of these moves. So you see, this is an elementary move I can assign to triangulation. I mean, you know, the spirit of quantum mechanics is that any observable or any operation should be assigned a unitary matrix element. And that's what the CG symbol is doing here. So if I use this property, and... Well, no, but I'm saying this is the, yeah, I mean, this comes from, you know, it's true because it comes from this property, that is, this amplitude will satisfy this identity, right? So that is, if I take this vector minus this vector and I compute the scalar product there, I will find zero. So this identity is true, you know, as an identity in my Hilbert space. So it's really a relation in my Hilbert space. But, you know, I'm trying to give an intuitive picture that any things I can do. That's what doing quantum geometry. Quantum geometry is just anything you can do, measure, move things, do things around, should be mapped into a unitary operator. It's a naive picture, and realize also this, yeah, more. So, you know, if I, suppose I look at this object, and then I do one flip move here, so I get there, and one flip move here, so then I get there, and then another flip move here, here. So then I get there. So each time, you know, it's implemented by a CG symbol. I can also start and do first a flip move on the other side here, and then another flip move on this side. I will end up there. So. And this is done by a product of two J symbols. So I get an identity which is such that the sum over some spin of a product of three J symbols is equal to a product of two J symbols. And I let you put the index right. It's an interesting. I'm going to give you the geometrical interpretation, which is essentially what I'm doing here, is that in terms of spin form evaluation, I'm showing that if you do the Ponzano-Regge spin form evaluation of this spin form here, it's going to be equal. And you see that there's an internal phase here. So because there's an internal phase, there's a sum over a spin. And then there are three vertex, so a 3J symbol. This guy is equal to the product of this configuration there. And now if I go, so that's the an identity of this, so that the when I, you know, there's an invariance in this Ponzano spin form model. That tells me if I evaluate it on such a complex or such a complex, it's the same thing. Now, if I look at the triangulation picture here, this object here is two tetrahedra glued along a common face here. Here, what I'm doing is I'm gluing three tetrahedra, but along a common internal edge. Okay, I hope you see. So the exterior is always the same. Here I take one and another, or here I put an edge in the middle and I glue three of them together. And okay. So now there's a theorem that tells me that if I have a triangulation. And there's an analogous theorem that for spin form, I said a spin form is associated to topology. But let me phrase it in terms of triangulation. It's a bit more intuitive. If I have two triangulation of the same topological manifold, then they correspond to this, they correspond to the same topological manifold. So two triangulation delta 1, delta 2, you know, correspond to the same manifold, m delta 1 is equal to m delta 2 as topological manifold, if the two triangulations are related by a series of Packner moves. That is, one of the Packner moves is this one, 2, 3, and the other Packner move, it's called the 1-4 move, is a refinement move, which is what you would use, you know, naturally to refine. So you take a tetrahedra, and then you put a vertex in the middle. Right? And here there's one tetrahedra, and here there's four tetrahedra glued there. So you can show that if you have two triangulations of the same manifold, you can relate one with the other by a series of finite number of moves. And here what we're seeing is that this system seems to be totally independent of the way we kind of subdivide our manifold in the interior. So the object here is, you know, independent of the triangulation or independent of the corresponding spin form. So it really depends only on the boundary data. So I can really take this object and then take the continuum limit, and then the continuum limit is trivially reached at some point. As long as I take an internal triangulation, which is fine enough, it will not move anymore. So this is almost true, except that I've shown invariance under this move, but not under this move. And as we will see, there is a problem with this move, but we're going to discuss that. Before discussing this, I want to describe the third property of this Sigge symbol, which is the asymptotics. And so suppose I look at a Sigge symbol like that, and then I look at a limit where I send all spins to infinity. So I take the limit h bar gi, fixed, and I send h bar to 0. Okay? So I send all spins to infinity and fixed, and let's call it li. Li, right? This is a fixed length. In fact, let me not put h bar, let me put lp. So I have my, you know, let's say Planck length, and I send the Planck length to 0, but by fixing the physical length to a finite entity. So this is the finite limit. Then you can show that this object as an asymptote, 1 over LP cube, 1 over 24 pi, the volume associated to this tetrahedra with edge length VLI, times the cosine of the Regé action divided by 1 over Planck length, where the Regé action here, as we have seen in Ruth talks, is just the sum over all edges of your tetrahedra, the length of the tetrahedra times the dihedral angle. Okay, so that's where we see that summing over spin is really summing over, you know, edge length of exactly the Einstein discretization of the Einstein action in 2 plus 1. Okay, except that now the edge lengths are real. And that's where the story started for Ponzano and Regé. So maybe just in the last 5 minutes, I want to say something about... okay. So far, so good. But there was a problem with this Ponzano-Regé model. It's the fact that... and it has to do with this move. It's the fact that... if you look at the amplitude I just defined, the sum over j is unrestricted. Okay? And okay, I have these coefficients, and because they are unitary metrics with a Planchrel measure of dj, you can show that they kind of decay, you know, polynomially in the spin, something like that, but not really exponentially or strongly. They are kind of oscillating, you see, coefficients there. So I might face divergence, and in fact, I do face divergence there. And it has been known for a long time that if I look at the spin from in the spin form picture, there's going to be divergence each time the spin form has a bubble in it. So a bubble is just a collection of phase that close onto, I have my collection of phase, and sometimes I can enclose a closed volume. Okay? In order for my spin foam to be dual to a manifold, this bubble should be really just a three sphere, or a two sphere. So this collection of phase form a closed cell here. And if you think in terms of the language of Feynman diagram, if you think that J is like momenta, and in sum over J is like integral over D3P, we know that usually divergences in Feynman diagrams are associated to loops. Here, somehow these Feynman diagrams are one-dimensional hops, so the divergences are associated to bubbles. That's the higher dimension of loops. And this prevents the understanding of this model for a long time, because it was formal. People tried to cut off, take the limit, but it's not clear that it was topological invariant. Then there's one model which is finite, which is Turiya-Viro, but you can't extend it to the Lorentzian case. So all these discussions were a bit formal. But what we have understood recently is that this infinity, in fact, should be there. It's very natural. It's just there because the action you started with has an extra symmetry, which is exactly this translational gauge symmetry. And then when you identify properly this gauge symmetry and you gauge fix it, this problem disappears and the model becomes a finite model, a well-defined model, for which you can really take the continuum limit of an infinitely fine triangulation. That is, this object is really invariant under this refinement move there. Okay, we can make a break now. Yeah.